The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anne Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from oprahmag.com. Okay, this first article is called Asking Jill Biden to Drop Doctor from Her Name is Telling All Women to Dumb It Down. I would like to say that I raged with anger when I read Joseph Epstein's Wall Street Journal op-ed, Is There a Doctor in the House? Not if you need an MD, which urges the First Lady-elect, or as he calls her, Madam First Lady, Mrs. Biden, Jill Kiddo, to drop the doctor from her name. In his opinion piece, Epstein writes that he's making the suggestion, think about it, Jill, and then forthwith drop the doc, because PhDs aren't impressive anymore, that real academics like him consider them Bush League. And furthermore, he insists, it feels fraudulent and comic to use the title, given that she's not a medical doctor, but a doctor of education. However, I suspect that his concern is less that Dr. Jill will be unable to perform CPR, should someone need it at the White House briefing, and more that he, Joseph Epstein, non-PhD, is not comfortable with women flaunting degrees other than an MRS. Given that conviction, I wish I could say that my first reaction to his condescending recommendation was to burn with righteous anger at the centuries of men telling us not to get too full of ourselves, that it's not an attractive quality in a woman, particularly a blonde like Dr. Biden, who's so pretty when she smiles. But I didn't rage. Instead, I laughed. It's a force of habit. Laughing when men move the finish line after we win the race, or kindly explain why our hard-won achievements aren't how they prefer to evaluate us. The implication being that their assessment is the only one that matters. It's what women have been doing for, ever? If we raged with fury every time someone kiddoed us, literally or figuratively, we'd have no energy left to get degrees in the first place. Epstein's argument took me back a decade or so, to a time when a kindly older man gave me some avuncular advice that was not dissimilar. I was 32 or 33, and a guy in my social circle asked me to dinner. It may have been a date. It may have been a friend thing. This was in a time and a place when it could be hard to tell. He ordered champagne for both of us. Date! And then he leaned over the table and said, I've been thinking about why you're still single. Friend thing. But given that he was 10 to 15 years older than myself, maybe he had some genuine insight. Oh, I said. Do you ever think men are intimidated by you? His forehead wrinkled, bent out of shape by the seriousness of the topic. I laughed. I'm only 5 feet tall. I'm not that intimidating. No. He crouched forward again. He was over 6 feet. Given the height difference, he may have been concerned that the words would float over my head, and I needed to hear this. I guess what I'm trying to say is, do you ever think you should just dumb it down? I was stunned into silence for a moment. Then I burst out laughing. Here's the thing, I said. Let's say that is my problem. If I dumb it down successfully enough to attract a man I want, then manage to trap the poor sap into marrying me, what happens when we're supposed to spend the rest of our lives together? I wake up the morning after the wedding and say, guess what, I'm not dumb. You're dumb that you thought I was dumb. And we live happily ever after in our web of lies? Yeah, he said, you probably couldn't do it. Not smart enough to play dumb, I took his advice back to my hive of equally intimidating girlfriends. Was this really what men wanted? A woman who was smart enough to build a resume to impress mom and dad, but not so smart as to be somehow intimidating. Naturally, two of my girlfriends and I spent part of a drive from Los Angeles to San Francisco that New Year's outlining the chapters for a playbook called Dumbing It Down, A Girl's Guide to the Good Life. It would be like The Rules, a horribly sexist bestseller that guaranteed you could get what you wanted. A man, naturally. A ring, definitely. If you could just suppress your true self long enough to lock it down. The first rule in Dumbing It Down was that you couldn't actually lie, because what kind of foundation is that for building a relationship? I was in the process of writing a novel and teaching undergrads while getting my MFA at Columbia. But Ivy League schools cancel each other out in the plus-minus columns. Writing is boring, and teaching little kids is noble, yet telling adult men how to improve their term papers is strident. So according to the guideline of the imaginary book, I would simply tell people I was in art school. It wasn't a lie, and it might inspire images of the pot-throwing scene in Ghost. Patrick Swayze's character may have been undead, but he was not intimidated by Demi Moore. Not when she got behind that wheel. My friend who was driving the car was a producer for a business network. But producing is man's work, and obviously, so is business. She sometimes voiced the internet segment she produced, so we decided instead we'd say she did voiceovers. The woman in the back seat worked in a lab. She's a biochemist. There's just no sexy, dumb way to spin that, so we had to focus on her leisure activities. She took yoga classes fairly regularly, so we agreed that if a man ever asked, "What do you do?" she would just say, "Yoga. I do a lot of yoga." We never got to the second rule of dumbing it down. Making up alternate jobs and fake personalities and describing them in breathy Marilyn Monroe voices stopped being fun fast. We started out amusing ourselves, but after a while it began to feel like we were still trying to please every professor, handing back a paper with a raised eyebrow and a shrug, every boss speaking over us, every man parsing our words to mentally swipe left when things got unfun. Every adult who ever warned nobody likes a know-it-all. But I'm still laughing about Joseph Epstein taking the time to explain to those of us non-academics why PhDs aren't what they used to be, and to advise the future First Lady to forget the small thrill of being Dr. Jill and focus on the larger thrill of being First Lady, a role defined by who she is married to, not what she has achieved. Because unlike a teacher handing out grades, a boss assigning tasks, or even a man pouring champagne while trying to puzzle out if you're worth the effort, Joseph Epstein has no power over Dr. Jill, and not much power over anyone anymore. In the wake of his essay, Northwestern University issued a statement noting that he hasn't taught there since 2003. "Joseph, Joey, kiddo, you have nothing Dr. Jill wants. Dr. Jill has her career. Dr. Jill has her title. She has a husband, too, so just because you don't find her PhD appealing, your implied threat that no one else will find her appealing is empty. In fact, it seems that Mr. Jill Biden has no problem with her being Dr. Jill. In fact, I bet he kind of likes it. And guess what? He's about to be sworn in as President of the United States. Dr. Jill is not running for office, and she doesn't have to play nice while a predator creeps on her shoulder like the Secretary of State did in the last election. She doesn't have to worry about whether or not her lipstick is too dark, her words are too intimidating, or her voice is too loud. Whether Epstein and his ilk like it or not, the doctor is in." Okay, this next article is called 11 Traditional Lunar New Year Foods to Eat in 2021. The Lunar New Year, celebrated in several Asian countries and best known for the Chinese New Year celebration that's also called Spring Festival, is a time to bring families together. That's one reason why the reunion dinner eaten by Chinese and Vietnamese families on the night before is such an important New Year's tradition. Putting an ample variety of food on the table is a must, too. The idea of an elaborate reunion dinner is that you have to include all sorts of stuff, says a private chef and author of Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, Essential Techniques of Authentic Chinese Cooking. You have to have fish. You have to have chicken or duck or pork. It's to indicate that you're so successful during the year that you can afford all of this and carry it over to the new year. As with holidays like Three Kings Day, Easter Sunday, and Diwali, the foods traditionally eaten during Chinese New Year hold a symbolic, not to mention delicious, place within the festivities. Foods like fish, fruit, and dumplings are more than mere snacks. They're symbols of luck and prosperity, and eating them is thought to invite both into your life in the days to come. There's actually several layers of symbolism at play when it comes to lucky Lunar New Year's dishes, what the food's name sounds like when said aloud, how it's prepared, and the way it's served can imbue a meal with extra meaning, making it all the more special. It's also important to know that because China is one of the largest countries in the world, the ingredients and preparation of any given dish is native to a specific region, even if Chinatowns across the United States have popularized them through what Americans think of as Chinese food. Every area of China has different customs. That means that a unified tradition that everyone celebrates is rare. But there are exceptions, and just as Christmas traditions vary by each family who celebrates, every Lunar New Year celebration is unique, which means that you may not find all of these dishes represented on every family or restaurant's table, but you will likely encounter several. Here are some examples of traditional Lunar New Year food for 2021 and what they all represent. First is sweet, glutinous rice cake. Sometimes translated as a New Year cake or just year cake, Nian Gao is made of glutinous rice flour or sweet glutinous rice flour, and it can either be sweet or it can be savory depending on the region. It's really sticky and dense, Ko says. He explains that Nian translates to year, which is a homophone for the word sticky. They're two different characters, but they're pronounced exactly the same. Gao loosely means higher up. So when said aloud, Nian Gao is meant to signal higher success in the new year. Often wrapped in paper and commonly eaten on Chinese New Year's Eve, the sweet variety of year cake that's more native to southern China is made with sugar, and it can be given as a gift for good fortune for the new year. The savory version is typically stir-fried in dishes. Another traditional food is whole fish. Fish is one of the most important symbolic dishes for Chinese New Year, Ko says, adding that you'll see fish at most every meal on the holiday served in various ways. This is an instance in which two words have two different characters but are pronounced the same way. The pronunciation for fish in Mandarin and many other dialects is yu, which is the same pronunciation as leftover, Ko continues. The idea is that every year you want an abundance of food or wealth so that you have it left over for the next year. Another traditional food in the new year is a whole chicken. Togetherness is an overarching theme of the Lunar New Year, and a whole chicken is another visual signifier of that unity. Serving a whole piece of meat symbolizes the reunion of the whole family, says Ko. Dumplings are also supposed to look like the ingot, the gold and silver pieces used as money in ancient times, Ko explains. You have all of this money you're eating, he says, laughing. The white dumpling wrapper most people are accustomed to seeing is associated with the silver ingot. But rarer is the egg wrapper dumpling, which is essentially an omelet with a filling inside, and that one signifies gold. According to tourism organization China Highlights, some believe that the fillings have certain lucky connotations themselves. Cabbage and radish eaten on New Year's Eve bodes well for skin and mood, while you should not eat Chinese sauerkraut dumplings because it implies a poor and difficult future. Sweet rice balls are called tangyuan. Ko says that Tongyuan is commonly served on the 15th and final day of the Chinese New Year celebration, which is also the Lantern Festival. Also made from glutinous rice flour, Ko likens the consistency to mochi, another kind of rice cake which is popular in Japan. It's served in a thin broth or deep fried. The balls are filled with anything sweet, from red bean to peanut to taro, although Ko's personal favorite is sesame. Another New Year food is braised shiitake mushrooms. Braised shiitake mushrooms with bok choy, a type of Chinese cabbage, is a vegetable dish that some families of Chinese heritage traditionally eat during Lunar New Year, among other special occasions. Simmered in an oyster sauce mixture, the mushrooms are a great option for those who don't eat meat. Just make it with vegetarian oyster sauce. Tangerines are the most traditional fruit to grace the table, says Ko, though you'll likely see oranges and other citrus fruits. Originally a Cantonese tradition, this is another instance of a homonym associated with luck. The word for tangerine is cheng, which sounds the same as a word that means good fortune. They're served at the end of the meal and also exchanged when you go visit relatives. Longevity noodles. Mostly served in southern China, longevity noodles are traditionally prepared as one very long, thin single strand. Nowadays, when you serve longevity noodles, it's really just very long noodles, Ko said. It's not a single strand. They're often combined with a broth or with an almost gravy-like sauce. Candy and other sweets. Anything sweet, like dried fruit or candy, is very common as a snack during Chinese New Year, Ko says, because it symbolizes a sweet life. And finally, spring rolls. While you might eat these savory fried rolls year-round, they're a Chinese New Year favorite because they symbolize wealth. There is a lucky saying associated with spring rolls, which means a ton of gold, suggesting that the spring rolls resemble gold bars. Okay, now we have an article called "A 90-Year-Old Woman Has Become the UK's First COVID-19 Vaccine Recipient." Maggie Keenan got herself a history-making early birthday present. The COVID-19 pandemic may be entering its latter days in the UK, as the first vaccine dose has officially been administered as of December 8th. The recipient was 90-year-old Margaret "Maggie" Keenan, who was given the shot by nurse May Parsons in the city of Coventry, England. "I feel so privileged to be the first person vaccinated against COVID-19. It's the best birthday present I could wish for because it means I can finally look forward to spending time with my family and friends in the new year. After being on my own for most of the year," she says. She turns 91 next week, according to the UK's National Health Service. In order to complete the vaccination process, the NHS said Keenan will receive a booster shot 21 days after the initial dose. Per NPR, there have been 1.7 million confirmed COVID-19 cases in the UK, and 400,000 people are currently able to receive the two-dose vaccine. Approval was given to the creators, Pfizer and BioNTech, a mere 6 days ago. The NHS has said that this will be its biggest vaccine campaign ever. Less than a year after the first case of this new disease was diagnosed, the NHS has now delivered the first clinically approved COVID-19 vaccination. That is a remarkable achievement. "The scientists and doctors who worked tirelessly and the volunteers who selflessly took part in the trials, thank you to all of these people." In that statement, Stevens acknowledged that the process of vaccinating people will take some months to complete, depending on how plentiful supplies are. NPR wrote that frontline health workers, long-term care facility workers, and residents over 80 years old will be first to receive the vaccination initially. The NHS also shared a video of Keenan and Parsons being cheered on by mask-clad healthcare workers after the shot was given. "I can't thank May and the NHS staff enough, who have looked after me tremendously, and my advice to anyone who offered the vaccine is take it. If I can have it at 90, then you can have it too, says Maggie. A timeline for any kind of large-scale immunization in the U.S. is unclear, despite promising developments. According to the New York Times, the Trump administration says that they could be distributing vaccinations to up to 24 million people by mid-January, despite some medical experts responding that such a plan is unrealistic and fails to account for potential setbacks. To meet those kinds of aggressive timelines, all the stars would have to align, says Baylor College of Medicine's Dr. Peter Hotez. According to the Washington Post, Pfizer has told Trump's team that they cannot provide additional doses to the United States until June or July due to commitments to other countries. Pfizer reportedly urged the American government's vaccine development group, Operation Warp Speed, to buy 200 million doses, though they opted out of half of that. Alternate vaccines are being developed by the companies Moderna and AstraZeneca, all of which have evidence that supports their efficacy, per the Washington Post. President-elect Joe Biden's COVID-19 plan is laid out in his campaign material. It includes investing $25 billion in vaccine development and ensuring that getting the vaccine will be free, and releasing clinical data to the public for approved vaccines. This kind of public transparency is important, as misinformation has been spread online to undermine trust in a potential vaccine. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases and White House coronavirus advisor, said on December 8th that if we implement the vaccine program properly and aggressively, the coronavirus pandemic could be under control by the latter half of 2021. He said that around 75% of the U.S. population must be vaccinated to have the umbrella of herd immunity necessary. Okay, this next article is called Meghan Markle Makes Powerful Surprise Speech to Thank Those Volunteering During COVID. After a couple of quiet weeks, Meghan Markle returned to the spotlight last night to make a surprise appearance on CNN's Heroes special. The Duchess, wearing a tan blouse and berry lip, made a heartfelt speech thanking those assisting with food delivery during the coronavirus pandemic. The speech came hours before Meghan announced her first investment in a startup called Clever Blends this morning, and Clever is spelled C-L-E-V-R. The brand makes instant oat milk lattes and is female-led and based in Santa Barbara. Oprah hinted at the announcement when she shared the Christmas gift her neighbor, and this is in quotes, M with a little crown emoji, gave her from the company. Both Meghan and Oprah live in Montana. And here's an excerpt of Meghan's speech yesterday. In a year that has been universally challenging for everyone, I'm inspired by the stories of compassion in our communities. Across the country, people have put their own needs aside to come together and support the collective well-being of those around them. Back in March, the COVID-19 crisis hit hard, and overnight, everything seemed to change. For many families, the impact of the pandemic has been catastrophic, and far too many were faced with a heartbreaking question: how am I going to put food on the table for my family? But in the face of this devastating reality, we also saw the power of the human spirit and the remarkable ways communities respond in challenging times. We saw the good in people, in our neighbors, and in entire communities coming together to say they would not stand by while our neighbors went hungry. We saw communities standing up and taking action. When kids' lunch programs came to a halt, we saw our neighbors make sure that those kids received the nutrition they need. And when those who were immunocompromised or most vulnerable couldn't leave their homes, we as a community showed up to deliver the food they needed to their doorsteps. We know the value of food as nourishment, as a life source, and in moments of crisis, the warmth of a meal can feel as comforting as a much-needed hug, especially in the absence of human contact due to the social distancing we've all been experiencing. These moments reminded so many that they're cared for. Tonight we are celebrating these quiet heroes, some of whom I know and others that we applaud from afar. These individuals stood up and made sure the most basic needs of our communities were met. They made sure that those around them did not have to suffer in isolation. They nourished their neighbors in more ways than one. And they showed us, all of us, that even in the darkest times, when we come together, we have the power to remind someone else that there is hope and we will be okay. Megan released the statement following the news of her investment in Clever Blends, calling out co-founder and CEO Hannah Mendoza specifically. The investment is in support of a passionate female entrepreneur who prioritizes building community alongside her business, she said. I'm proud to invest in Hannah's commitment to sourcing ethical ingredients and creating a product that I personally love and has a holistic approach to wellness. I believe in her, and I believe in her company. All right, and sticking with this theme, here is an article called Oprah Shares Neighbor Meghan Markle Sent Her a Special Christmas Gift Basket. Oprah kicked off the 12 days of Christmas with a bang, thanks to a gift basket from her neighbor, the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle. The special delivery contained oat milk latte ingredients from Clever. Markle and her husband, Prince Harry, moved to Santa Barbara, California earlier this year, putting them in the same area as Oprah. On the first day of Christmas, my neighbor M sent to me a basket of deliciousness, Oprah shared with a video of the gift on Instagram. My new drink of choice for the morning and night. Wish I had Clever Blend sooner because I would have added it to my favorite things list. Her 2020 favorite things list does, however, include some items that would pair well with latte ingredients, including a Breville Barista Pro and mugs from Corksicle. Clever is a new company that sells instant oat milk lattes, offering everything from coffee to matcha to chai. Per Fortune, this is Markle's first public investment, and she reportedly made a point of supporting companies that were founded by women. Oprah and Markle have been friends for years, with the former being a guest at the latter's high-profile 2018 royal wedding. Oprah even wrote about the experience. I thought immediately of the history, the legacy, the astounding moment Meghan Markle was stepping into, and what it would take to be prepared for such a moment, she wrote about attending the royal wedding. The life she was leaving behind and the new world to which she was rising, all part of a destiny she helped design. Oprah also has a relationship with Markle's mother, Doria, and has supported her as she's navigated the newfound attention and scrutiny on her family. In January, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex announced that they had decided to step back as members of the royal family before moving to the United States. All right, this next article is called Michelle Obama Defends First Lady-Elect Dr. Jill Biden After That Misogynistic Op-Ed. And the photo shows Michelle Obama dressed in a maroon coat, and she's smiling. She's standing next to Jill Biden, who is also smiling, wearing a white coat. On Friday evening, the Wall Street Journal published an op-ed criticizing First Lady-Elect Dr. Jill Biden's use of the title Doctor before her name. People expressed their anger and frustration on Twitter, calling the op-ed a disgusting display of misogyny as well as sexist and disrespectful. Michelle Obama has something to say about it as well. On Monday morning, the former First Lady posted a message on Instagram, praising Dr. Biden's accomplishments and asking us, "Is this really the example we want to set for the next generation?" I'm going to read her full response. "For 8 years now, I saw Dr. Jill Biden do what a lot of professional women do, successfully manage more than one responsibility at a time. From her teaching duties to her official obligations in the White House to her roles as a mother, wife, and friend. And right now, we're all seeing what happens to so many professional women, whether their titles are Doctor, Ms., Mrs., or even First Lady. All too often, our accomplishments are met with skepticism, even derision. We're doubted by those who choose the weakness of ridicule over the strength of respect. And yet, somehow, their words can stick, after decades of work, we're forced to prove ourselves all over again. Is this really the example we want to set for the next generation? Dr. Biden gives us a better example. And this is why I feel so strongly that we could not ask for a better First Lady. She will be a terrific role model, not just for young girls, but for all of us, wearing her accomplishments with grace, good humor, and yes, pride. I'm thrilled that the world will see what I have come to know, a brilliant woman who has distinguished herself in her profession and with the life she lives every day, always seeking to lift others up rather than tearing them down. All right, this next article is called The Vow Explains How NXIVM's Allison Mack Went from Smallville to Leading a Sex Cult. In 1998, Keith Raniere, an erstwhile vitamin salesman with a history of multi-level marketing schemes under his belt, he co-founded a new venture that would become known as NXIVM. Billed as executive success partners at the time, the company purported to teach clients how to become the best versions of themselves. Just over 20 years later, Raniere, called Vanguard by his followers, would be convicted for acts he committed as the group's leader, including sex trafficking, racketeering, and forced labor conspiracy. Actress Allison Mack, who rose through NXIVM's ranks to become a senior figure in her 12 years, would make headlines for her own arrest, facing similar charges, while Raniere was sentenced to a 120-year prison sentence on October 27th, Mack is currently under house arrest. She also filed for divorce from fellow member Nikki Klein in December 2020, per legal documents. Once known for her role as Chloe Sullivan on teen Superman drama Smallville, Allison Mack has admitted to coercing a number of NXIVM's female members into a lifestyle of self-harming behavior at Raniere's command. Within Dominus Obsequious Sororium, or DOS, a secret subgroup that claimed to foster women's empowerment, Mack allegedly enforced a master-slave dynamic in which slave members were paddled, required to submit humiliating collateral material to their master for potential blackmail purposes, and deprived of food to achieve the rail-thin physique Raniere preferred. Many say they were also pressured into sex with Vanguard and held down as a brand featuring his and Mack's initials was seared into their skin. Mack's role in NXIVM is discussed throughout The Vow, HBO's 2020 documentary series on the group, which is evidently getting a season 2. Here's how Allison Mack became a prominent member, what she allegedly did, and an update on where the 38-year-old actress is now. And no, it is not jail. Mack attended her first meeting in 2006 after her co-star Kristen Kreuk had become involved with the group, according to sources cited in a Hollywood Reporter feature. The event was a 2-day introduction to NESS. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's J-N-E-S-S, an arm of NXIVM specifically geared toward women. The group for men was called the Society of Protectors. As a source told THR, Lauren Salzman, daughter of NXIVM co-founder Nancy Salzman, immediately ingratiated herself to the then-popular CW star. Following the seminar, Mack was invited to the Albany, New York area to meet Raniere during one of his weekly volleyball games. Like many NXIVM moments, their first conversation was recorded and appears in The Vow. Smallville was in its fifth season at the time, and Mack enrolled in many pricey intensive courses. Barbara Boucher, an ex of Raniere's and former high-ranking member, took Mack under her wing as a mentee from 2006 until Boucher's departure in 2009. As Mack leveled up the ranks, Raniere entrusted her to lead an organization under NXIVM's umbrella called The Source. As Mack describes it in a recruitment video with Raniere, it's a curriculum specifically for actors that draws upon Raniere's rational inquiry method of self-improvement. By the time Mac joined, Nexium had faced criticism for years. A 2003 Forbes cover story on the controversial Rainier and executive success programs deemed the leader a corporate Svengali. In the piece, multi-billionaire head of Seagram Beverage Company, Edgar Bronfman Sr., whose heiress daughters Sarah and Claire Bronfman would effectively bankroll Nexium, with around $150 million total as longtime members, put it plainly, "I think it's a cult." But Mac and her colleagues tirelessly recruited new members for more than a decade. Among the events designed to attract young prospects was Acapella Innovations, a multi-day festival billed as a university singing showcase held in 2007 and 2008, with the first co-hosted by Krug, Mac, and Battlestar Galactica actress Nikki Klein. Rick Allen Ross, a self-described cult deprogrammer, told THR of Mac, "She was the Tom Cruise of Nexium." Krug, meanwhile, maintains that she cut ties with the group around 2013, had minimal contact with those still involved, and was disturbed by the details of the scandal. By the time Smallville ended in 2011, despite a few acting gigs including a recurring part on FX's Wilfred, Mac had purchased a home in the Albany area to be near Rainier and the group. DOS was Rainier's idea, and Mac helped carry it out. During the trial of Keith Rainier, a woman named Nicole testified that Mac, who she'd met through taking an $8,000 acting class with The Source, told her in 2016 about a really cool women's mentorship program for women who were serious about being strong women. In reality, DOS employed tactics of mental and physical abuse, often to groom members for sex with Rainier, to be part of what former members describe as his rotating harem of between 12 and 20 women. Like Nexium itself, DOS had the structure of a classic pyramid scheme. As told in The Vow and in court testimony during Rainier's trial, a woman would join at the ground level status of slave, but were told they could eventually ascend through the four levels of the slave pyramid to become a master of a pod themselves. Lauren Salzman, a first-line master within DOS, testified that there were five stages of recruitment. In stage one, a prospect would be asked for collateral as a symbol of vested trust in a prospective master. In court, Nicole testified that Mac had requested a sexually explicit video and a letter falsely accusing her own father of molesting her in childhood. Mac had allegedly provided the same collateral. Later, when Nicole expressed that she wanted to leave DOS, she said Mac made her afraid the damaging materials would be released. "It's the choice you made. Now what are you going to do about it?" Mac wrote in an email to Nicole. When DOS members complained of how they were treated, their master would tell them that their fear was a sign of weakness they should push past. By 2016, Mac's slave pod included actress Catherine Oxenberg's daughter, India, as well as Nicole and at least two other women. In weekly meetings at her home, Nicole said Mac would berate them as they sat on the floor and demanded that some follow diets like her own of 500 calories a day. Another former Hera member told THR that if Rainier felt she wasn't thin enough, he would blame his erection problems on her weight. In 2017, Mac shared an Instagram selfie posing with a group of women on a road trip north, at least one of which was believed to be a DOS slave of Mac's. Okay, this photo, it's an Instagram photo. It shows these four women. They're all smiling, huge smiles. They're in a coffee shop. Looks like a totally normal picture. They're wearing t-shirts. And Mac's caption reads, "Coffee shop stop on a short trip north. I got good ingredients in my life. ... for sure. Hashtag nourishment. Hashtag soul food. Hashtag inspiration. Hashtag friendship." As former member Sarah Edmondson recounts in The Vow, slaves had to text their master to request permission to eat and sleep, and immediately reply to readiness drills that their master sent them at all hours. The masters, including Mac, required their slaves to pose smiling together, nude, for family photos that they'd sent to Grandmaster Rainier. Mac also allegedly threatened to release collateral if her slaves did not agree to sleep with Rainier, saying that to refuse would violate the vow they took of lifelong obedience. Corporal punishment the DOS slaves endured included standing barefoot in the snow, as well as beatings with a leather strap administered during cold showers. Salzman testified that there were additional plans to build a dungeon with a cage in it beneath the house the first line members lived in outside of Albany. Mac's slaves were seared with a brand featuring her initials. Though DOS slaves were often told the brand symbolized the four elements, it was actually a combination of Rainier and Mac's initials. "We were told that we'd all be receiving an identical tattoo the size of a dime," Edmondson, whose master was Lauren Salzman, writes in her memoir, Scarred. "Instead, we took turns holding each of the other members down on a table as Nexium's resident female doctor dragged a red-hot, cauterizing pen across the sensitive area just below their bikini line. The women screamed in pain as the smell of burnt flesh filled the air." Salzman said in a testimony, "It was the most painful thing I've ever experienced." Nicole testified that Mac told her, "Pain is love, and you show your love to your master by pain." This was by Rainier's design, according to recorded conversations with Mac in which they planned the ceremony together. "Do you think the person who's being branded should be completely nude and sort of held to the table like sort of a sacrifice?" Rainier mused in the recording. News of the branding ceremonies broke in June 2017 on the site of Frank Parlato, a controversial figure who became an early Nexium whistleblower following work as a publicist for the group. The vow shows that Edmondson was one of his sources. The report led to a high-profile story in the New York Times months later. With investigators on the scent, Rainier, Mac, Salzman, and others fled to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, where federal agents found Rainier hiding in a closet in March 2018. In video of the arrest obtained by the Daily Mail, a gaunt and dazed-looking Mac appears in frame as law enforcement drives away with Rainier in custody. In December 2020, TMZ reported that Mac had filed divorce documents in Orange County, California. Per federal transcripts, Mac told prosecutors that she had married Klein in 2017 under Rainier's order, so that Canada-born Klein could remain with the group in the States. And there's a picture here. It's an Instagram photo of Mac and Klein. And Klein is like leaning on Mac's shoulder. And Mac is just smiling, a huge happy smile. She's wearing a denim shirt. It looks like a totally normal photo. And the caption says, "Pretty sure this is the poster for my so-called life, the new class." Klein, who never faced any criminal charges for her role in Nexium, is still an active supporter of Keith Rainier's. Alongside fellow former members of the group in the summer of 2020, Klein staged daily dance parties outside of the Brooklyn prison where Rainier was held, ahead of his October sentencing, as part of a new organization called the Forgotten Ones. According to the BK Reader, the regular dancing first arose when Klein would dance for Rainier while visiting him from outside the Metropolitan Detention Center. Soon the group's dancing reportedly became popular among other prisoners who had a shared view. In September 2020, Klein appeared with other Rainier defenders in an interview with CBS News. Asked about the allegations that Nexium was a sex cult, Klein said, "I don't even know how to define what that is." Asked about Mac at the time, Klein said, "I haven't been able to speak to her for a year and a half. Part of the condition of her bail is that she can't speak to anyone who is affiliated in any way with the case or with Nexium." She called the series of events since 2018 the hardest, most humbling experience of my life, but said, "I wouldn't trade my experiences for anything." And here's another picture showing, it's an Instagram post, and it's showing an empty bus. And then in the next picture, It's Mac and Klein seated together in the bus seats with huge happy smiles. And the caption of this one reads, City days, early morning trains to make the most of our adventure. Hashtag day trippin'. Hashtag soul sisters. Hashtag NYC summer love. And then there's a video showing the two of them laughing really hard. And it says, end of the day, heading to a birthday celebration at the theater. I love my friend. Hashtag belly laughs. Hashtag nourishment. Hashtag soul food. Hashtag love in Tampa. Mac pled guilty and is currently on house arrest. When Mac was arrested in April 2018, she initially pleaded not guilty to sex trafficking and conspiracy charges related to her role in DOS. After a few days stint in jail, she was released to her parents' custody in California that same month on the condition she wouldn't use her phone or the internet, nor travel for reasons not connected to the case. However, per a September 2020 Vice article citing student reports and screenshots, Mac had evidently been using her computer to take virtual gender studies courses at UC Berkeley, including one titled The History and Practice of Human Rights. After classmates' outcry upon learning of Mac's presence in the class, a person claiming to be a student wrote in a Reddit post that Mac was allegedly asked to leave a gender, sex, and power course after a week. The unconfirmed report also claimed Mac may have continued on as a student. Mac's last Instagram post, a reshared video, is dated March 22, 2018. The last photo is a photo of Mac with her mother. It's a black and white photo, and they're both smiling up the camera. And as of August 2020, she is understood to still be under electronic surveillance at her parents' house. A year after her arrest, Mac pleaded guilty to racketeering and racketeering conspiracy, admitting to state law extortion and forced labor. The New York Times reports that she tearfully told the Brooklyn court that she joined NXIVM to find purpose and admitted to recruiting DOS members under false pretenses of mentorship. She also confessed to forcing them to submit damaging collateral, which she then leveraged for labor and services, and apologized for the hurt caused by her misguided adherence to Keith Raniere's teachings. Mac's charges carry a potential for 40 years of prison time, but it remains unclear whether she has cut a plea deal with prosecutors. Her original sentencing date, scheduled for September 11, 2019, was delayed with no new date announced. Meanwhile, whether Mac should be held fully culpable for her actions while under the longtime sway of Raniere remains a topic of debate. Even whistleblower Frank Parlato has directed a plea for mercy toward sentencing U.S. District Court Judge Nicholas G. Garofis. I don't think she was actually trafficking girls, Mac's former roommate told THR. It doesn't mean she doesn't deserve punishment, but I think she had drunk enough Kool-Aid to really believe that these girls were going to save the world with Raniere's super sperm. All right, this next article is called Matt James Says It's an Honor to Be the First Black Bachelor. Here's what we know about the 29-year-old North Carolina native. Matt James has made history as the first black man to be named The Bachelor in the show's 18-year history. The announcement of James as The Bachelor came after years of criticism of the show's lack of diversity, which has mounted in this critical cultural moment. Over 80,000 people signed an online petition urging The Bachelor to reflect and to honor the racial diversity of our country, both in front of and behind the camera. I don't think it's ever the wrong time to do the right thing, James said on Good Morning America, addressing the franchise's past and a path forward. Hopefully this is the first of many black men to be in the position that I'm in now. The 25th season of The Bachelor, following a season of The Bachelorette, featured the show's first Latina leads. Until January 4th, we're going to study up on James, the philanthropic former college football pro who gives free food tours to low-income elementary schoolers in New York City. Speaking to Good Morning America, James said, I hope people see that I'm not that much different from them, and that diverse love stories are beautiful, James said. Until now, across 40 seasons of casting, Bachelorette Rachel Lindsay had been the franchise's only black lead. Lindsay has been a vocal critic of the franchise's glaring lack of diverse cast members. While she says James's casting is a step in the right direction, she hopes for a more systemic overhaul. I want producers of color, Lindsay said on Good Morning America. I'd like for them to cast leads that are interested in dating outside of their race, that aren't just getting their first-time experience, for the first time on national TV. I need the acknowledgement of that. Not putting a band-aid over the situation and just saying, here, we're going to put this here. Are you happy now? James took part in the Black Lives Matter movement protest sweeping the nation and world in the summer of 2020. He opened up about his experiences with microaggressions in the Instagram caption. It's cool, his mom is white. Or how about, nah, he's good, he's an athlete. Do we have to lead with those things to be treated fairly? This is for everyone who isn't given the benefit of the doubt. It's everybody versus racism. In the trailer for The Bachelor, James admitted that he had never been in love before. But with 32 women gathered in Pennsylvania to win him over, that might change. Speaking to his girlfriend, E.T.'s Lauren Zima, host Chris Harrison said James was going to be stripped naked emotionally during this season. He compared James to Ben Higgins, the lead of The Bachelor's 20th season. There is a lot of depth and a lot of issues that we have to get over, Harrison continued. I was trying to think of another Bachelor, maybe like a Ben Higgins of a guy that went on this journey and all of a sudden got kind of stripped naked emotionally and realized, wow, there are a lot of things I have to deal with in my life to get to where I want to be in a relationship, Harrison said. As for what James will be dealing with, we'll have to stay tuned to find out. He's best friends with The Bachelorette's Tyler Cameron. Tyler Cameron rose to fame as the fan favorite pick on the 15th season of The Bachelorette, led by Hannah Brown. As a core member of Cameron's friend crew, James has also become a figure known by Bachelor fans. James and Cameron met while playing football at Wake Forest University and have been best friends ever since. In fact, they're so close, they even have their own couple name. Hashtag Myler. Before the pandemic began, they had been roommates in New York City, where James worked as an associate for a commercial real estate company. Now they have another thing in common, stints on Bachelor Nation. In a bittersweet twist, it was Cameron's late mother, Andrea, who nominated James to be on The Bachelor. James, who towers at 6'5", balanced being a wide receiver for the Wake Forest Demon Deacons while completing his coursework as an economics major. After graduating, he tried his hand at the NFL, earning a tryout with the Carolina Panthers and the New Orleans Saints. And there's a photo of him playing football. Though his football days are behind him, James stays fit. According to his Instagram, he can run a mile in just over 6 minutes. And there's an Instagram photo of him shirtless, wearing shorts and sneakers, and he is ripped. You can see every muscle. Sometimes he plays golf, too. James gives back through his organization, ABC Food Tours. This bachelor has a heart of gold. A year after moving to New York from Raleigh, North Carolina, James started ABC Food Tours, a nonprofit organization with a philanthropic mission. ABC Food Tours gives paying tours to tourists and free tours to underserved elementary school kids. Once a month, James took the students of PS 188 on a culinary voyage of their own neighborhood, sampling the Lower East Side's restaurants as tourist mate. Over half of PS 188 students are homeless, and nearly all are low income. Each tour includes a donation of socks for a homeless family and revelations for the children that many of the restaurant owners overcame disadvantaged beginnings to reach success, Wake Forest Magazine said of the tours. In addition to visiting local restaurants, James took students behind the scenes at the East Coast burger chain Shake Shack. PS 188's principal, Sonny Ramos, raved about James while speaking to Wake Forest Magazine. I don't have the words for what he has done for our community and for my family. Because this school is my family, Ramos said. He's amazing. He's a positive role model. He's sweet. He's charismatic. He has a way of getting the children to listen to him. Since launching, James has expanded ABC tours to the West Coast, too. His mom is his inspiration. James was raised by a single mother. While speaking to Wake Forest magazine, James called his mom, Pat, his inspiration. Judging by his Instagram, they appear to be very close. She's going to be excited, James said of his mom, while announcing the news of his bachelordom on Good Morning America. She's just now finding out. His quarantine crew included Hannah Brown of The Bachelorette. Starting in March, James spent much of lockdown in a Florida house with a group that included two Bachelor Nation alumni, Tyler Cameron and Hannah Brown. The friends call themselves the Quarantine Crew, and they've documented their hijinks in TikTok videos and Instagram updates. And here's a photo of all of them, big group of them, and they're all dressed for the beach. James appears close with Brown, who was the bachelorette on the show's 15th season. In May of 2020, Brown made headlines for saying the N-word while singing along to a song on Instagram Live. According to E! News, Brown immediately reached out to James to apologize, in addition to apologizing publicly. Matt is looking to the positives in the situation, and he wants Hannah to learn from this, a source told E! News in May. He and Tyler discuss things, and they both agree they know Hannah is not racist at her core, but both think she needs to use her platform to learn from this and spread awareness. Upon hearing the news of James's casting, Brown took to Instagram Live, yet again, to announce her excitement. I could not be more excited. Y'all should be so freaking excited because he's like the best human being in the entire world. Y'all, this is amazing, she said, per ET. His faith is very important to him. James lists Believer in his Instagram bio and opened up about his faith in an interview. Other than becoming a Christian, moving to Wake Forest was the best decision I ever made, he told Wake Forest magazine. ABC President Casey Burke said in a statement, "We all have a responsibility to make sure the love stories we're seeing on screen are representative of the world we live in, and we are proudly in service to our audience." We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.